This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can everyone hear me? We've got these funny wired up things. I never quite know if you can hear us. Welcome to this talk on the joy of slow travel. My name is Adrian Phillips. I'm a travel writer specialising in outdoors travel and also the managing director of Bratt Travel Guides, who have a series of books, the only series of books, on slow travel around the UK. And with me today are three real devotees of slow travel. Let me start from that end. We've got Christopher Somerville, who is a long-term walking correspondent for previously The Telegraph and now The Times, and the author also of 40 books on slow travel. His recent book, the most recent book, The January Man, charts his travels around the UK following journeys that he previously took with his father, and is an exploration as much of his relationship, his former relationship with his father, as the landscapes themselves. As somebody who does a lot of walking, he says he has a very strict approach to nutrition and diet, and he's, I think over the course, he says, of 40 years, he's had 2 energy bars, 3 isotonic drinks, 1,900 pies, and 9,000 pints of beer. So it's good to hear that walking doesn't have to be healthy and worthy. That's Christopher. Second, we have Anna Hughes. Anna is a lifelong cyclist and environmentalist, and she, in 2011, took a cycle journey all the way around the coast of Britain, 4,000 miles, and she wrote, on the back of that, her book, Eat, Sleep and Cycle. She's a lover of the great outdoors and is also a champion of the Ordnance Survey's Get Outdoors initiative, I guess you'd call it, and also a great lover of water. So 2 years after cycling around Britain, the coast, Anna sailed around the coast of Britain and now lives on a narrow boat and has done for the last 4 years. So properly living the slow way of life. And finally, we have Nick Hunt. Nick has walked much of Europe and is a writer for various publications and also a storyteller and editor for something called the Dark Mountain Project, which I understand is an author collective and have a good website. Do check out the website. His latest book is Where the Wild Winds Are, which tells the story of his journeys following 4 winds around Europe. Nick says that, rather ironically, given his status, he's got a terrible sense of direction, although I would have thought it would be even more ironic if he's got terrible wind, but we can ask him about whether that's the case a bit later. The plan for this is that we'll talk a bit about slow travel, and then towards the end, there'll be the opportunity for you to ask some questions if you have any questions. And then obviously after that, there'll also be the opportunity for you to buy and some signed copies of these books here over there, I believe it is. But I want to kick it off by asking what slow travel is. Everyone might have their different definitions. Anna, perhaps we could start with you.
So I suppose slow travel is different in any scenario. So examples include, I chose not to fly as a way of getting around, and so instead if I were visiting Europe, for example, I would take the train, which in itself isn't a particularly slow way to travel, but when compared to flying, it very much is. So a journey to Copenhagen, rather than taking a couple of hours, would take a couple of days. And it's about kind of seeing the journey as part of the experience, rather than the experience starting when you step off the plane. And then in my daily life, using the bicycle to get around, so that is faster than walking, but it is a slow way when compared to travelling by car, for example. So it's kind of it's a lot to do with what you're trying to achieve from your travelling, and so it's not necessarily about the speed, it's a lot about the mindset and about the experiences that you're having.
Do you have any, that's encapsulated it quite nice, I think, but everyone has a slightly different take. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Nick? I'd say the thing about the mindset is absolutely true. Slow travel for me it sounds weird, but it's often the easiest way of doing things. My first book was an 8-month walk to Istanbul. Obviously, that's not the easiest way to get to Istanbul. But in terms of getting from place to place, if you're a foreigner somewhere, you have to stand at a bus stop, work out how the bus timetable works, work out what to do on the bus. Do you pay the guy on the bus? Do you buy a voucher here? It's very confusing. And then you're landed into the middle of a city with no concept of direction. You don't know where north, south, east, west are. You don't know where you came from, where you're going. And I found that after having done months of walking, putting myself in those situations was amazingly stressful, as was any lift I was offered in a car was almost quite traumatic. When you travel slowly, you are in complete control of you know, your pace and your thinking to a certain extent. So for me, often it's easier. It feels easier mentally and spiritually, if that doesn't sound too crazy, than getting on a bus or a train or a plane.
It's really interesting. I've never heard anyone describe that, but that's exactly why I travel slowly. I've got a terrible sense of direction. And I'm very nervous getting on buses and things in foreign countries. And so you walk, it's easier. Christopher, how about you? Do you have anything?
I think it's about taking your time. Mm-hmm. It's an obvious thing to say. I did a walk across Crete to celebrate my 50th birthday, and I took 7 weeks to cross all those mountains. And in the middle, I stopped at a taverna where a friend of mine runs it, and spent 2 weeks just on the balcony, eating oranges, looking at the landscape, writing poems, drinking wine, thinking my thoughts. And it's an opportunity that people just don't get in ordinary life. So it taught me that whatever journey you're taking, give the five senses a chance to enjoy themselves, and just take your time, make time to do nothing in the middle of your travel.
But I mean, the title of this, you've painted a very evocative picture of slow travel. Is it always a joy? I mean, I was walking from the station here today outside in the rain and cold, and I must admit I would have much rather been flying here or in a helicopter, but talk us through the realities of it. It presumably isn't always joyful, or is it?
Well, no, you're liable to get lost or snowed off or lost in the fog like you did. But there's something about overcoming those challenges which is gratifying at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's much, much more joyful than not joyful. And there's just a sense of you set off for a walk. You're not trying to set a particular time frame for yourself. You're going to go there and enjoy every moment, literally every moment, that you're doing the walk. And I wouldn't say it's ever a pain. It's always a pleasure.
Anna, you, Christopher mentioned the challenge and that being part of it. Your trip around the coast of Britain, that was in itself the goal. How easy was it to enjoy the journey?
Sorry, we're getting some urgent waving from...
Sound up. Can we put the sound... I think it might be Christopher's... you've used that. That's easier, yeah.
Who can't you hear?
Christopher. Is it Christopher you can't hear?
Hey, can you hear me? Are you all there? Yes. Come on,
come along. Anna, you know, that's a challenge in itself. Do you forget? Is it easy to remember to enjoy what you're doing when you're always looking at the end game?
Yeah, that's a real trick with any travelling, I think, to really focus on the journey rather than the destination. And that can also be applied to any aspects of our lives. So I think with such... the way we live at the moment is often focused on the gratification or an instant gratification of whatever it is that we're doing. And we kind of focus on that aim, that ultimate goal, at the expense of how we're going to get there and the learning that you can do as part of that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when I cycled around Britain, I had all of my overnight stops planned in advance. That just kind of helped. It was my first really big adventure, and I felt that that would help me in the practicalities of it. And it did. It meant I wasn't traipsing around with a tent, which was good. And it did mean I had a nice warm bed and a cosy pillow every night, which is also great. But it did risk the fact that I might have just purely focused on, okay, I have to get to X place today, which is however many miles it is. Right, let's get there. And that would have been a fairly miserable experience because I wouldn't have seen anything apart from the house I was staying in, and what's the point of that? So it was there were several times during the journey I had to stop myself and say, I'm not doing this to cycle to the next place. I'm doing this so I can experience the right here and now and see all this amazing stuff and be able to, first of all, be satisfied with the fact that I have powered myself to get there, mm-hmm. And also to have felt the evolving landscape. That was something that I really felt was quite wonderful about experiencing every corner of Britain and knowing how it all connected and feeling how it all connected. But yes, making sure that it was a journey in itself and every part of the journey meant as much as the previous and the next, and it wasn't just a series of hopping between destinations. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, you all of you travelled on your own, and Nick, you've said you've got a terrible sense of direction and feel quite nervous. Was it an enjoyable experience from that point of view? I mean, is it something you can entirely enjoy and let yourself go, or are you always slightly nervous?
Yeah, I didn't feel nervous. I do have a bad sense of direction, but that's, in a way, an excuse to meet people,
yeah.
Because you ask directions. I mean, it's not always enjoyable, no. I think often, you know, travel books, you can write about the pain and the moment you're kind of find yourself sobbing in a thunderstorm, and you know, because that's exciting.
Yes.
What's often skipped, I think, certainly by me, is the monotony that you get sometimes. Yeah. Because obviously, you know, you're in an environment for a very long time. So if that happens to be industrial suburbs, or you know, just like the edge of a ring road, it's not exciting. It's not horrible enough to be exciting, but it's horrible enough to affect you deeply at that time. And it's quite hard to write about in a way that's interesting to anyone else that isn't you.
How do you cope with that? I mean, that's an occupational hazard of this, isn't it? I mean, you're travelling for a long time on your own, and you need to stimulate something.
John Hillaby, the great travel writer, wrote about something that he called the skull cinema,
yes.
Which was that thing that you enter in your mind when you've been travelling. If, say, you're walking, you've done 5 or 6 miles, you're in good rhythm, and then you retreat into your skull cinema. Yes. Snap on one reader, which might be about nothing to do with the walk. It's some fantasy, or it's something that you try to remember a song, or you start to whistle, and it makes you think of the time you were in Ireland at that session in the pub, or whatever it was.
Yes.
It's like a little refresher course. You rinse the psyche out and dry it off, and then carry on with your walk. So there's never a place which is boring, because you're either interested in what's going on around you, or you're in the skull cinema. Wrestling a lion, or whatever you're doing it.
and you, I mean, you've walked everywhere. How does it compare the UK as a walking destination compared with, say, Europe, where Nick has walked? I mean, do you have a?
They're very different. But I would say what I would say about the UK is that we have the best system of footpaths in the world. Mm-hmm. It's an unbelievable figure. We have 140,000 miles of footpaths, all interconnected. And the Ordnance Survey maps to show exactly where they are.
Yes.
So we're completely spoiled for walking. And within this 900-mile linear section of land, we've got tremendous variety from the oldest to the youngest rocks, and the way that the landscape changes and undulates between places. So I'd say that, on the whole, on balance, probably UK walkers are luckiest in the world, but there is a problem with the footpaths, which is that as money is getting tighter and tighter, and the county council's footpath offices get cut, and their jobs get cut, and they get amalgamated, it's harder and harder to keep those footpaths in order, and it's more and more up to these people like the ramblers, volunteers, to go out with their secretaries and do it themselves.
And it's funny, actually, because that very network, the reason it's so open and accessible is because of people taking affirmative action in the 1930s and saying, you know, we want the right to be able to cross land and so on. Yeah. What, I mean, you've talked about, you know, some of the pain of it, and Nick, you alluded to the fact that, you know, sometimes you find yourself talking about the painful moments. In a way, I mean, it's been said in the past, you know, if you're writing a good story, a good travel story, there has to be something that goes wrong, otherwise it's slightly boring.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, are you looking for things going wrong when you're travelling?
I'm not always disappointed that they do go wrong.
No,
sure.
No.
Yeah. Because obviously it's more interesting to write about and more interesting to read about.
So you're always hoping you'll fall down a hill? Or
oh, yeah. You know, I set up accidents for myself all the
break
time.
Break a small bone. Yeah. How about you, Anna? I mean, obviously you don't want your challenge to go wrong. You want to achieve it. But was it a... You know, was there in a sense in which you didn't want everything to go smoothly the whole way around?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the bad stories or the tribulations, they make great reading. And if, you know, anyone who has a blog will tell you the times when you're telling about when you fell off a cliff or, you know, was stuck in a bog or whatever, those are the ones that get the most hits. But, yeah...
You didn't fall off a cliff, did you?
No, I didn't fall off a cliff. But the... And in any period of time, whatever you're doing, there will be good times and bad times. And perhaps when you are traveling, it's magnified because it's not just the daily life that you're dealing with. These are new experiences every day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is monotony, of course there is. But that monotony in itself is quite interesting because you're doing something that you don't usually do. There will be a lot of repetition because as... The title of my book implies eat, sleep, cycle. That's all I did for 3 months.
You did a lot of eating of fish and chips, it seems to me.
Yes. And with any of the journeys, it's one foot in front of the other, whether that be on a pedal or just physically on the ground. And so it can become that kind of that monotony. But focusing on those, there are obviously wonderful times and there are really terrible times. And I suppose what we write about as travel writers is the wonderful times, the terrible times, and then a little bit of linking with the general monotony.
I think that there's also, I'm quite kind of suspicious of the kind of, you know, the macho, whether that's a man or a woman, yeah. I go into the wilderness and survive. And, you know, there's a huge amount of conceitedness about that. And I'm saying that as someone that's very much on the borderline of doing that for my job. Mm-hmm. But that kind of where it starts to blend into the more obnoxious elements of extreme sports, yes. where it's just kind yes. of me versus mountain. Yes.
And there are so many books and TV programs now that seem to be about conquering the land rather than enjoying it.
Absolutely, in the language of conquest and the language of invasion, and it's like a military campaign.
Yeah. And in fact, there's a lovely quote from Edmund Hillary, which is, it is not the mountains we conquer, but ourselves. So, you know, we're not conquering landscape. We're actually, it's ourselves that we're challenging. And
Would you be doing these journeys if you weren't writing about them? Obviously, most people won't be doing this while writing. They'll do it for pleasure or whatever. Is it something you would be doing, a journey of this type, if you weren't writing about it?
That's a very interesting point. As a professional writer, you have to be able to pitch an expert. Has to catch the attention of your editor agent and your publisher and the wider public. So it'd be false to say, I'm just going to do exactly what I want, and then magically it's published and sells 100,000 copies. You have to craft something which you know is going to catch some attention. In the case of January Man, I wouldn't have done that anyway, because I was writing about these walks. We wanted to put them together to make a picture of during the course of a year. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I probably wouldn't have shaped it the same way.
No.
If I hadn't had to, I didn't have to make a good story out of it.
Yes.
And the same if you're writing a 600-word novel at times, you give it a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And you craft.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because that's your job, is to craft.
Well, yes.
But what's in it, true? It's not that one's thoughts about it. You're just shaping it.
Yes.
I think it can be a little bit dangerous to undertake your journeys with a view to writing about them, simply because then you're looking at your experiences through the eyes of a potential future reader, and that could well shape what your thoughts are at the time. The journeys I've undertaken and have always been for the journey first, and then you know, the next year there's still enough in my mind that makes me think, yes, this is a story worth telling, then I'll tell it. So there are, I'm sure it can kind of work both ways, but I take notes and make blogs and things at the time.
Actually, how do each of you practically record what you're doing as you're going along? Is it stopping and taking notes, or are you banking it and writing up at the end of the night?
Notebooks,
yeah. So as you're walking, you're writing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
very strong.
Yes.
I do say about people's point about the purpose of about shaping something and shaping work. When I set up to write a book across the street, which is a 300-mile journey across these mountains, somebody said to me, forget the editor of your background. Silence it, don't shut up.
Yes. Yes.
Because then you will have a pure experience, you'll have a slow experience, and whatever happens, you'll be open to it.
Yes.
Somebody says, if the editor says, or the blue book says, there's a benign temple on the next hill, you must go and see it, it's a benign temple. Actually, somebody say to you, come and enjoy our Orange Festival tomorrow.
Yes.
Yes. You can see the dancing.
Yes.
That's what you do.
Yes.
But I'd say remove the editor, but not the writer.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of believe in this idea of the journey first, but I think for me, often the writing leads me, because writing is a form of attention. You know, it's just a form of looking at things and being interested in the world, and like you say, having that openness. So I think for
me, it's interesting that idea of somebody looking over your shoulder, because there's a point in your book when you're thinking of cutting down a post that's a signpost to use as firewood because you're freezing, you need it, and then you comment, but actually I thought what the future reader would have thought of that and decided not to.
Exactly,
and I thought that was very interesting.
Because you're cross-furling the Pennines, firewood, and I was, seriously, there's a nice sturdy fence post, like a dividing one field from another, and I really thought about it. It would have made a lovely few logs, and I just couldn't do it.
For all we know, you did it and just left it out. But related to this issue of writing while you're doing it, is slow travel therefore something that only professionals or frankly people of means can do, because everybody else has a job to do and go to the office and they simply don't have the luxury of the time to give to it?
I was thinking about this a bit, because it can seem that way. You know, to be an adventurer, you need to, it's either your job or you need to have loads of time and loads of money. But I think you definitely need to be time rich, because of course we're talking about slow travel, which takes time. But you don't have to be money rich. So for example, my 3-month journey around the coast of Britain was, it cost me £1,000, and it would have cost more than that to pay rent. I gave up my flat before I left, but I would have paid more than that just living, just paying rent.
Yes.
And also...
But that required some big sacrifice. I mean, you had to give up your job.
Yeah.
You broke up your relationship to do it.
I did, yeah. Yeah,
Yeah,
there are lots of other considerations.
But everything's a sacrifice, isn't it? If you hadn't done it, that would have been a sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't. I wouldn't be sitting here now. And you know, my life is very much shaped by what, and all of our lives are shaped by what we've done. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. But one of the things that also strikes me about that question is now I am very time rich but very cash poor, and so a lot of my journeys are through necessity. I ride my bike because I cannot afford to get the train. Mm-hmm. So last week I cycled 120 miles to go to stay over for a weekend, because I just, you know, that was the option to cycle that. And I stayed at my cousin's house, so I had a 3 nights accommodation, and she cooked me dinner, and that was all very nice. And that is a journey that I will remember for a long time, and I wouldn't have remembered a train journey in the same way, because, you know, train journeys just come and go. And, yeah, by taking the time to do this, to get to where we're going, even if it is for a mundane thing, you know, there's no special reason that I was making that journey, but... through having done it in that way, for whatever reason, makes me remember it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think if you take the Southern Rail network, it tends to go very slowly anyway. You have no choice. Nick, in your book, you make a very interesting point about travel always as being following something, which I thought was really interesting, because when you read travel narratives, it always seems to be about trying to find a new quest that hasn't been done before. But effectively, you're saying you're never doing anything new. You're always following something. I mean, talk about the idea that you had of following winds and the ways in which they shape the landscape rather than man, shape man rather than the man shaping the landscape, which seems to be so frequently the way that people.
Well, thinking specifically about travel writing as being following a coastline or the seasons, or a border, or a trade route, or a migration network, or, you know, frontier of some old kingdom. And I saw a map that had the roots of Europe's winds as these big kind of coloured arrows that looked like magical roads that I'd never seen before, and they all had wonderful names like Mistral and Tramontana and Bora and Sirocco, these fairy tale evocative names. And so that was what drew me. It was like seeing these kind of invisible pathways suddenly made visible. So the book is about following these seasonal named winds of Europe. And they affect people all kinds of ways. I mean, they drive people crazy.
I don't know how many Scots people, but you said you always find that wild highlands always make wild people, and which again was very interesting. Give some examples of ways in which winds shape a community. I know that's a big thing, but is there any particular example that sticks out for you?
Mate, yeah, the one that really sticks out is, because a lot of it sounds like old wives' tales and weird urban legends. I spent 3 weeks in Switzerland looking for the fern, which is this great hot, dry wind that comes through the mountains. And without exception, everyone I met said the fern causes nosebleeds, insomnia, psychosis, suicide, murder. And it's this incredibly violent, neurotic list of ailments. And I was there, as a writer with my notebook, observing people, making intelligent observations. And I never thought that I would be affected. Mm-hmm. I was there to listen to other people's stories. Yeah. The fern started blowing, and after a day and a half, I experienced the most crushing anxiety and depression I've ever felt.
Amazing.
And it took me a good day of misery to realise, this is what's meant to happen.
Amazing.
So when you say that, is slow travel always pleasant? That absolutely not. I found myself up a valley in the Swiss Alps, too exhausted and enervated to move, with this kind of mad blackness. And if I'd have had a car, I'd have driven away and got into the next valley where it wasn't happening.
Yeah.
But I had to walk out, and that was
incredible.
Yeah, the winds do, they really...
You genuinely get inside your head. And Christopher, I mean, your book is effectively following memories, I guess. I mean, it's doing it in a structured way, in a very interesting way. But you say that you see walks as a way of developing a relationship or forging a relationship between a father and a son. I mean, can you talk more about that for those that haven't read the book?
My father was a great walker, really keen walker, and of an old-fashioned sort. So it was French-aged children between 5 meters. A bottle of sober water. And we just closed out of the door. But he could do 15 miles or 20 miles.
Yes. Yeah.
My father was from a generation which served the war. Mm. He was a reticent man. He was upright, he was good, he was dutiful, he was sensible. The moral compass was always pointed towards those parts of his role. And for me, I'm 68 now, and for me and a lot of people my age, getting to know their parents was quite a difficult thing, because there seemed to be this barrier, partly their experiences during the war. My father was a naval officer in the Mediterranean, the Dutch campaign. And partly because they had this moral, high ground. If you were a teenager in the 1960s, you didn't want moral high ground, moral low ground.
Yeah, yeah.
So walking was a way in my 20s. We went up through the Pennine Way, which is 270 miles of mud and misery and sodden and mist and bad beds and bad fear and getting lost and all that stuff. Because it was great. Because it brought us together.
Yes.
Basically the challenge for me.
Yes.
And since then, we've done a lot of work together. And I found that we both felt that we could open up, partly because a very simple thing. You're not face to face like this.
Yes, yeah.
Your side goes on.
Yes.
So you're talking to
the
landscape in a way, yes. It's less. Yes.
So the stuff you can say, which you couldn't say, is and it was a rather wonderful thing. I didn't realise that until 10 years after my father died, when I was writing this book. And then memories of how it actually was, and some more analysis came in. And yet, I felt that I knew him and loved him better than I'd done when he was alive, which was a.
Is it still relevant now? Maybe ask Anna and Nick. Chris was talking about the war generation and therefore this slight barrier. It was a real sea change of a moment. But is that sort of dynamic still at play now with a generation down? You know, where there isn't quite that frigidity, perhaps, between two generations. Is it still a way of breaking down boundaries? Do they need breaking down?
I mean, what Christopher said about walking side by side.
Did you do that? Was that your way into walking?
My walks are alone.
Yes, but when you got into it originally, was it something that started early on, or was it something you fell into?
It was my mum. My mum is a walker, and she taught me to walk, you know, in two ways.
Yes.
She taught me to walk,
yes.
walk,
yes. Yes. Yes.
and to find the value in that.
Yeah.
And I think it's absolutely true that you have a very different experience with someone walking side by side, and it's facing someone across a table. Yeah. It's quite a kind of confrontational way as if you're walking together, you're involved in an activity, you're in that meditative state, you're experiencing common factors, the rain, the clouds, the ground at your feet. So I think my mum taught me that.
Is maybe something which British men fight, particularly?
Maybe.
Men and their fathers.
Yes.
Maybe women into different things.
The times I've related to my dad most have been, I think, when we're walking in the same direction rather than staring at each other, yeah.
Do you, any experience of that? I mean, was there a sense in which walking was a way of forging a relationship with others for you, or was it just you liked the challenge of getting out there into the great outdoors and it was more a visceral thing?
I suppose, I mean, not particularly with my parents or my family, but although we did do, we did a family 10-mile walk when I was a child. I think I completed most of it on my dad's shoulders, but we still got the family prize. The one long walk I've undertaken, I did that with a friend, and there were lots of moments of silence, which was actually a wonderful way to get to know him, because we had been friends for a long time and we had lots in common, and whenever you meet up with your friends, you chat the whole time, and you whatever your social interaction is, or the social glue that holds you together. But when you're walking for 10 hours side by side, you cannot talk for that whole time. And it was just actually really... I felt that I was getting to know him as much in the silences as I was in the conversations we were having.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And how about engaging with other people? I mean, the nature of what you're doing means you are constantly meeting new people and then leaving them and meeting them. How do you find they receive you when they hear what you're doing, for instance? Is that a way into engagement with them, or do they think, what are you, this barmy?
Ideally, romantically, I'd say yes. Practically speaking, further north you go, the more abrupt meetings, the greetings are, and the less time people seem to have to.
Why is that? What, your accent is different? You should practice your Scottish accent, then.
it's strange. You meet very few other walkers on the kind of walks that I do. It's funny. It's the country's most fastest growing and most enjoyed leisure activity. Which is very rare to see other walkers. Probably because I'm constantly tracing footpaths that aren't public, national trails.
Right.
The smaller footpaths between farms and so on, where people often seem quite scared to go. Mm-hmm. They're not sure if they're trespassing. If you meet a person who's mending a dry stone wall, then you have a fantastic conversation, you learn something, and it can last 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and it's a wonderful thing. But people coming towards you, you stop, you pass the time of day, and then you're off.
Yes.
I'd say it really depends where you are physically. In the walks I've done, they haven't all been in on footpaths or in beautiful picturesque places. If you've got a rucksack, unshaven face, muddy clothes, and you're in the mountains, it's fine.
Yes.
Now, if you're beside a river, it's fine. You're allowed to be there. If you're walking down someone's street, you're suspicious.
Yes.
If you're sneaking around the back of a factory, you're a potential terrorist.
Yes.
And it really amazed me how the different filters that I'd see people looking at me with, you know, if you're a place that isn't sort of designed or designated for walkers, you're treated very differently.
Is there a sense in which if you're travelling abroad, because you're a foreigner, it's easier because they assume you're a tourist somehow? You know, that there's a reason for being there because you're a tourist, and that makes it easier to engage, or do you find it easier in the UK?
Can I just jump in with, because most of my experiences have been within the UK, so I can't compare it directly to experiences elsewhere, but you often hear stories of the kindness of strangers around the world, which is a wonderful thing to experience, but I have experienced that so much here in the UK, and it is people in Essex, and it doesn't have to be, you know, the people, the welcoming people of Scotland, whatever it is. But this may well be a topic for a whole other panel, but it may well be because I'm a woman who often travels alone. Mm-hmm. A woman by themselves is somebody to be helped, or as a man by themselves is perhaps someone to be suspicious of.
And does having a bike help? I mean, it gives a sense of that you're actually doing something, whereas
I suppose
scouting a burglar, scouting out a burglary or something.
Perhaps,
if you've got a bike, it looks a bit...
Well, possibly. I mean, I'm definitely... Yeah, and obviously with so many bags on the bike, I'm obviously a traveller. I'm obviously out, not just going shopping or whatever. And perhaps I'm considered a good person because I ride a bike. I don't know that, you know, that may be the case. Perhaps good is the wrong word, but perhaps a non-scary person because I ride a bike.
Yes.
You've got a justification in a way. People know what that is and what you're doing with
it. And back to the whole... a global thing, that vehicle is recognised around
the world. I think we've got a few minutes left. It'd be nice to open up the floor. I don't know whether you've got a microphone, given that you can't hear us with microphones. I think the chance of us hearing you with no microphone
is
minimal. Just behind you here, this lady here.
Anna, this one's kind of for you. I don't know whether you've entered events, because I'm a cyclist too, you know, the sort of Ride London or Birmingham, whatever. But do you find that the you have to weigh up the experience as opposed to, you know, the time that it takes to actually do it? Because there's always that dilemma and getting sidetracked, and then you decide, oh, Lord, I just want to really enjoy it, as opposed to sort of like bust a gut to get there. Sort of like in 8 hours or whatever it's going to take you.
Yeah, definitely. And those two types of event are very different. So yes, I have done Sportives, I have done Ride 100, and that is absolutely a case of getting to the finish line. And you can enjoy the journey, of course, but it's a very different type of enjoyment. So I enjoy the fact that I can cycle up Box Hill without stopping, and you know, and I'm really pushing hard and it really hurts, but this is great. And when I'm travelling for touring purposes, it is wholly different, and there is no shame in pushing up a hill. And there's definitely not quite so that lung-busting type of travel. So yeah, I think they're very different things, and but positive experiences to be had from both.
Any other gentlemen here?
Where was the best place on the coast that you went, and where was the worst place?
Too many best places to name, perhaps. But I was especially thrilled with the west coast of Scotland. It was somewhere I had vaguely visited before, but I absolutely loved it. I loved the peace, I loved the quiet, I loved the remoteness, I loved the mountains, I loved the sun setting over the sea, I loved the beaches. And it was hard cycling, but really rewarding. Similarly for Cornwall and Devon, the weather was just phenomenal when I went there, and that really helped because the cycling is very hard. That is without doubt the hardest place to ride within the UK. Very, very steep and plenty of hills. And I hate to say it, but I really didn't get on well with Wales, even though that's where my heritage is. My grandfather's Welsh. And that wasn't anything... That was simply because of the scenario and the circumstance and the time I was there, because it happened to coincide with hurricane season. So I got blown around a lot, which was very miserable. It also was just about halfway through my journey, which is, I think, perhaps the most difficult point of any journey. You've travelled halfway, so you've still got all that time until you get back home again, and you can kind of start to get lost within your own head a little bit. And I had also developed a couple of physical strains at that point. So yeah, nothing against Wales, but that wasn't great.
Gentleman there.
All right, I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
There's a question particularly for Nick. Your first book was Following in Someone's Footsteps, and your second book was one that you, in a sense, carved out yourself. So what was the difference, as in your mindset or practically in terms of following someone else or carving out your own journey and in your writing as well?
Well, the first book was following not just any old person, but Patrick Leigh Fermor, who casts a great shadow over travel writing and was a kind of towering personality. So in a sense, the second book was quite a relief not to be in his footsteps, his giant footsteps. the second book is, it was carving out my own journey, but it was following the wind paths. And even though that sometimes took a bit of imagination, there felt like there was a logical route for me to follow. I missed having Patrick Leigh Fermor's voice to guide me, because the wind was a much more, obviously it's what you read into it. But following the invisible was the reason I wanted to do it. Was it's such a kind of absurd idea, and it seemed entirely ridiculous at times. So it was a kind of joy to make a journey out of something you can't see.
Christopher, I don't know. Oh, there's one here. Sorry.
If you weren't being published, would you still be writing?
There's one for you, Christopher.
Certainly not. The answer lies in a bottom drawer where there's a 723-page manuscript called The Red Man, which is a novel that I wrote with no hope of being published, about an obscure 6th century Irish hermit. Possibly a key clue to my personal project. But I had to write that. Poems, I'd be writing poems, still no matter whether they're published or not, because it's an intense, absolutely intense draw to do that. And I'd probably be making, with my wife Jane, I'd probably be making nature notes about things I saw on walks and so on. So I wouldn't be crafting special journals unless there was a book by me.
Yeah, I have an answer to that as well, because I write because I love writing, and every piece I write makes me a better writer. I hope that, you know, you get better by doing something. But there are reasons to write books such as these, and they are, first of all, to share your experiences and partly to inspire other people to either live your experiences through your writing or try and do some of it themselves. At least for me, that's my motivation. But yeah, that is a very specialised type of writing, and that can't come all the time. So a lot of it is just for your own pleasure, for your own process, etc.
Yeah, yeah. I think the same for me. I started off writing, short stories and fiction are where my heart is to an extent. And the becoming a travel writer was a bit of an accident. It wasn't what I planned to do, but I loved travelling and knew that it was important. So I'd be writing something, even if it wasn't these. Yeah.
We might have time for one more. I don't know if there is one more. Doesn't look like there is.
At the back.
Ah, here we go, there is.
Run.
Quick.
Yeah, cheers. I thought I'd better fill the gap. You mentioned about slowly travelling and such, but I'm one of these people, if I did anything like that, I'd have to have all my accommodation every night set. But do you do that, or how do you get around that, just enjoying the journey and not worrying about where am I going to stay tonight?
Well, Annie, you said you set yours up, but Christopher, how did you set all your accommodation up in advance of a trip, or do you just see where you want to stay?
This wasn't really a trip. This was
no, but more generally, more, if we talk it more generally, would you travel slowly without arranging where you're going?
Again, if I was being honest and practical about it, I have to get my copy in to the Times, and I have to do it every week, and I have to be able to write it out in a reasonable state of mind. So I absolutely plan everything to the nth degree, so that certainly I can do my job.
Yes.
But walking across the street, I didn't plan anything at all. The whole idea was, set off, enjoy it, drop that burden,
Yes.
An editor. Yes. Drop those worries. Drop those paranoid fears of that dogs. Lost on the mountainside. Just to see if you can enjoy it. Just
yes.
Walk. You know the path is supposed to be blown off, it wasn't. Go out in the company of strangers. See people's porches. Be invited in. Throw yourself at the mercy of life.
Yes.
It was utterly magical.
And in a sense, I suppose the very purest form of slow travel would be to let the wind take you where it does and not try to set things up in advance. In a sense, you don't know what to expect if you set it up in advance, do you?
Yeah.
Booking
it's
on.
Great privilege
to be able to do that.
Yes.
Of course. Yes. It doesn't hurt if you've made a career doing it.
Yes.
People know that's what you're
yes.
doing. Yes. You're sort of yes. entitled yes. to
yes.
take that
yes.
time
yes.
off.
Yes.
But it's just building in those extra day or two where you don't know what you're doing, you don't know where you're staying, you don't know where you're going. Something always turns up to
excite
yes.
you.
Yes.
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 Yeah, it's like having a bit of planned uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's quite
yeah,
I like to kind of lay out a few dots of a safe home and a warm bed, and then between them there can be a bit of vagueness. I think it keeps things interesting, and having the option of a tent is great. Having the option of sleeping in a porch is great.
Yeah.
If the opportunity presents itself.
I think that's all we've got time for. Our time is up. As I said, Nick, Anna and Christopher will be signing copies of their books over there. There's a little booth. But thank you all very much for coming along and listening. And I hope it's inspired you to do some slow travelling and even writing yourselves. Thank you very much.